and we think that we have a full 45 minutes of content, if not more, so it does seem like the keynote was going to run over.
Is he
still going down there?
No. He was not talking anymore. Okay. I came straight up here, though, so if anyone stopped, really, for a moment, they're not here yet.
We're down to the spring.
Yeah, I say we should go ahead and get started, and if others trickle in, that's great. So we're being locked in.
Oh, fantastic. Escape room. This is what you're suggesting.
That's right, yeah. We tricked you.
So that's the interactive portion of the panel.
The cabin door has been shut.
Millennials are really into escape rooms.
Yeah, so. Right. All right. So this session is entitled Administrative Best Practices for Engaging Millennial Faculty. And my name is Rusty Carpenter. I'm an executive director at Eastern Kentucky University. And I have the Knoll Studio for Academic Creativity Faculty Center for Teaching Learning. EKU Summer, and a few other programs that are in my queue, but one of the things that the Faculty Center for Teaching and Learning does is faculty development. So that's has been an area of interest to me, and we'll go, we'll go left to right and do brief intros.
Hi everybody, my name is Kevin DeWore. I am an executive director and professor of the Nova Southeastern University Writing and Communication Center, and one of the things that we do in our WCC is faculty development, teaching writing across the curriculum, teaching communication skills across the curriculum. I am also now, happily maybe, in charge of our first year experience program, which onboards instructors throughout the entire university, many of whom are not faculty, but staff or administration, and we have to get them ready to instruct first year experience courses this fall.
Hi everyone, I'm Shanti Bruce from Nova Southeastern University. I'm Assistant Dean of the School of Communication, Media, and the Arts. We have lots of programs at the undergrad and the graduate level. And all together with our adjunct and full-time faculty, I'm working with about 66 faculty. So this is an important topic for me as well.
Hey everyone, so my name is Michael Strauser. Contrary to your digital program, I am not in philosophy. So long story short, the reason I adopted, I'm not pompous, the reason I adopted my middle initial is because there is another Michael Strauser at the University of Central Florida who at one time, and actually I think still is the department chair for philosophy. So I am not that Michael Strauser, but I just went to UCF from, I was at a small liberal arts college in Louisville, Kentucky called Bellarmine. And while I was at Bellarmine, I oversaw our graduate programs in the School of Communication and did a couple other administrative things. So, but yeah, I am communication, not philosophy. So I'll tell you a little bit more about that in just a little bit.
The real Michael Strauser.
Right, the real Michael Strauser, because I use the middle initial.
So we'll do a few things in this session. We'll talk about some of the generational differences, kind of a broad overview of how we came to an interest in millennial faculty specifically. We'll talk about some of the expectations for the new professoriate, all kind of engaged in different aspects of this. For me, it's an interest in initiatives like new faculty orientation and the expectations for faculty as they're coming into the university, but we each come to that from a different perspective. We do have some interactive portions, so we might reassign or maybe kind of combine tables here. I'm going to leave Kevin up to that. and then we'll have some panel questions for discussion. I want to talk a little bit about how we came to this session in particular and our interest in engaging millennial faculty. And it started with a conversation that Michael and I were having around the time that we were working on this collection, which came out in 2019, Engaging Millennial Faculty. We had some big questions and some concerns, some things that we are seeing on our different campuses. Generational disconnects. That is, a lot of the things that we're doing to either onboard or develop our faculty were kind of based in literature and practices that have been passed on for many years. We became concerned with that. So we've explored some of the generational research, looked for ways to apply that to faculty development, and in this collection asked university-level leaders from a variety of different institutions, various institutional contexts, coming at this conversation from multiple perspectives to weigh in just a bit on what they were seeing on their own campuses and help us to transfer some of that knowledge to a set of evidence-based and best practices. So we had a few goals as well. We're very interested in your perspective, so expanding the conversation about what you're seeing on your campuses among millennial faculty, helping us to refine this conversation a little bit as well and think about what we can do to apply on our own campuses in a variety of contexts. So in thinking about how we engage millennial faculty, so how we work with millennial faculty, we're looking at this from a number of different perspectives. But as millennial faculty are coming to campus, they're coming to us with a certain set of expectations, either derived from where they were previously, maybe where they did their doctorate work, or personal preferences based on their life experiences. So obviously the higher education system, this larger system, is changing. So some really big questions about whether we're ready at university or at colleges to receive millennial faculty. Is the system built for them? Is it built in a way that will ensure that they are successful and representative of their intellectual, their work, and preferences? So we have these questions. And we've really looked for different ways to apply this work to kind of rethink the culture at our colleges and universities for the millennial faculty member. So we'll talk a little bit about some of the generational research.
So thank you, Rusty. So just a little bit of disclosure. I don't like to admit this readily, but I will. So I am a millennial faculty member. I do not like to. Thank you, please. As a millennial, I expect applause after I say that. So, but I like to consider myself a realistic millennial faculty member. I'm pretty self-deprecating when it comes to stereotypes about myself and my millennial cohort. But it's interesting. I think now that I'm at a university that's a little bit different than the one that I previously came from, I went from 3,500 students to almost 70,000 students, so a drastically different world for me that I'm in now than what I was. But at my previous institution, as an administrator, I oversaw our graduate programs. I was a millennial faculty overseeing and leading faculty from all other different generations. And so I think that taught me a lot about how I'm wired, right, what I expect, but then also how to lead in the midst of dealing with those generational differences, because they're real. And I think we would be remiss to assume that we can fit everybody into a particular box and say all people born within this, particular demographic, these particular sets of years that Pew Research Center decided that everyone is the same. But there are some kind of striking similarities with people who have that same generational distinction, right? But I think part of what we're seeing now, and part of what we have to come to grasp with, is that millennial faculty are wired a little bit different. And I'll just kind of include myself. At my previous institution, I was the faculty member who was asking, I want to go up for tenure early. To which somebody would say, well, why? And I would say, well, look at my CV. I'm doing okay. I want to go up for tenure early. And then they would say, yeah, but why? You haven't paid your dues. And I would say, yeah, I have. Boom, boom, boom. At my current institution, I'm the faculty member that's looking at my department chair and saying, hey, just so you know, I want to go up for tenure early. That's a millennial faculty trait, I think, that we're seeing and are going to continue to see. I'm the guy, this makes me sound like a jerk, I promise you, I try not to be. But I'm the guy in meetings who will ask those same but why questions of my colleagues. But why? Why are we doing it that way? Why do we continue to ask or continue to kind of relish in the status quo? If it doesn't work, why do we continue to do that? And I think one of the things that you see about millennials is that that's kind of that MO, right? Yes, there is a little bit of entitlement there. But millennials are also perfectionists who I think genuinely, it just kind of depends, if they are asking for things that they feel they are entitled to, the ones who are asking those questions, hopefully, will have at least given some indication that they're deserved. Now, I think that doesn't necessarily happen all the time. But when I think there's some debate in terms of how we categorize generational differences, right? For me, I always go back to Pew because I think it makes sense, and I think their reasoning makes sense in terms of why they allocate certain years. The other thing that Pew Research Center is willing to do is change their years for different demographics, right, for different generations. And so I like that willingness to be humble, where they can say, hey, you know what, we were a little bit off. And so even recently, they changed. I think their initial cutoff for millennials went into the early 2000s, and Pew came back and said, you know what, we think that's a little bit too late. And so they identified 96 as that cutoff between millennial faculty and, or millennials and Generation Z. What we're seeing now, and you are probably just in the midst of this, right, in your department meetings and in your institutions, is that you're seeing that first wave of millennial faculty who either have recently gone up for tenure, who are going up for tenure. And then we're also seeing a lot more staff positions filled with Generation Z as they start to graduate. So it's a little bit of a shift, right, a generational shift. So let's talk just really briefly about some differences. These are all stereotypes, right, so we need to be careful. Differences between some of these generations. And I want to pick out a few of these that I think are most applicable. So for the most part, so boomers, born between 1946 and 1964, the OK boomer movement, it's ridiculous, but that's part of how millennials act out, right, as we create some meme or some stinging banter and post it all over social media in hopes that somebody reads it. So baby boomers, a couple different things about this. Work-life imbalance, right? Very anti-millennial. I want to focus on a couple of these that are anti-millennial. Millennials crave balance. They crave flexibility. For me, part of the reason why I went from a tenure-track position at a liberal arts university to a tenure-track position at an R1 was actually so I would have more time. Because my liberal arts institution was asking me to do a lot more. And so I looked at it and said, and it's supposed to be the opposite, right? So I looked at it and said, I have more autonomy, I have more freedom if I move to a Research One institution. That's part of the reason why I made the decision. Baby boomers tend to be career loyalists as well. That means that they have, for the most part, right, a lot of them have stayed with one particular organization and worked their way up. And so the job hopping that millennials do, case in point, right, That tends to rub them the wrong way, right? Partly because they think it's anti-loyal, partly because, again, it's that element of pay your dues. Like, I went through some rough spots in my position. Why can't you, right? Baby boomers also tend to have a strong work ethic, live to work. They like that flat organizational hierarchy. I think all of those are kind of interesting as you think about how those relate today. Gen X. So this is part of what's interesting now is that I think we're seeing, for years we've been talking about kind of the great boomer tidal wave, right? As boomers retire, we're going to see this drastic change. We're still waiting for a lot of boomers to retire. I'm not sure if most boomers ever will retire. My dad is a really good example of that. Retirement's not in his vocabulary. But, you know, it's interesting. One of the things that we're seeing is that because of the number of millennials, there are a lot more millennials than there are Generation X. And because a lot of those boomers have waited so long to retire, administrative positions in a lot of different organizations that are now being filled by millennials, and Generation X has kind of gotten skipped over a little bit when it comes to executive or leadership positions, which is kind of interesting, right? But Generation X, you'll see part of the reason why I think they will look at that and just kind of shake their head or roll their eyes is because they're also wired to think a little bit more in cynical terms, right? So, well, of course I would get skipped over and somebody younger than me would get that job. Tend to be pretty pragmatic, self-reliant, tend to be independent, right? Very independent. That's very anti-millennial. Millennials love working in collaborative teams. If you look at my CV, 98% of what I write is with collaborative research teams on purpose. I like it. Makes sense to me, right? But that's not necessarily a Gen X trait, where they tend to be a little bit more silent. Very results-oriented, confident, but a little bit angry. I think it's kind of interesting. Some of you who are Gen X are laughing. Millennials, so those born within this 15-year window. So again, Pew Research Center looked at their initial designation and said, we need to bump this back a little bit, because we are noticing some really interesting trends post-1996. Now, the other thing that Pew Research Center is not as guilty of as other entities is Pew will also like to designate older versus newer millennials, and even take these different groups of millennials and kind of split them in half. So I would be considered an older millennial, and as such, a little bit different, right? So I didn't go through high school with inordinate amounts of social media. I was in college when the iPhone really took off, right? My experience is different than those who are even 4 to 5 years younger than me. Same 15-year gap, but still a drastically different world in which I grew up. So millennials tend to be very achievement-oriented, perfectionist, confident, tech-savvy. They want that instant gratification, hence why I tell my department chair ahead of time, hey, I just want to let you know, I'm probably going to go up early for dinner. Can you help me? Right? Teams, collaboration, a little bit entitled, pretty self-absorbed. Open to new ideas when they make sense, right? Millennials actually love innovation. They love doing something different. That's why they're open to new ideas. They don't tend to like the status quo, especially if the status quo isn't working. And so for millennials, higher ed can be frustrating because it takes a long time for things to change, right? And a lot of higher ed, kind of we keep doing what we've always done for various reasons. So what we want to do really quick, we want to make this interactive, right? But and I know we're kind of spread out a little bit, so feel free to stay at your own table or kind of move. But we'd love for you just to gather in groups of maybe 3 to 5 and just talk about some initial questions that you have about engaging millennial faculty, maybe some challenges, some struggles, some different things that you're dealing with. And I'll give you maybe 3 to 5 minutes for that, and we can kind of come back together. All right, so what initial questions did you all talk about, or what were some initial things that came up at your tables?
Bueller?
Bueller has to
answer.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, a lot of nurturing, a lot of support.
Yeah.
Especially with their ideals and connectivity on the job, you know, with the faculty. And I have one he likes. I try to give him a lot of freedom. A lot of support, and just say I'm with you.
Right. Go for it.
Yes,
that's good. But the nurturing is kind of interesting, right? I always tell people, yes, I'm a millennial, but I actually probably am wired a lot more like a Gen Xer than I am millennial. For me, the best thing you can do for me if you're my boss is give me the runway. I don't need for feedback. I don't need you to let me know I'm doing a good job. Just say, go.
Okay. It's pretty much what I just said. I just let him go and ride the wave.
Yeah. Energy, previously unknown to mankind, right? What else? Some other things.
We were talking about how the boomer generation into college came in, planned to work all the way up to 10 years, stayed for 20, 30 years, and they would be president and they would get involved in committees. And we have the new faculty, the millennials, that are out at 2, I'm going home to hear my kid, whatever. Yeah. Don't really care about the committee, whatever. So we're wondering, like, don't you see the importance of being here and doing all this stuff? But maybe they don't even think about staying for 20 or 30 years. So the career ladder doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So one of the things that came up, I really have two comments related to it. But the first is, it seems to me, based on what you're describing, that really kind of written plan, if you will, kind of know, hey, this is what we're doing, and then get out of it. Is one part of that, you know, in terms of engagement. But one of the things I've also found tricky is that it tends to be, hey, I'm taking off, or I'm not serving on this committee, as opposed to what I've noticed with other faculty at different generations that say, is that okay?
That's a major
difference.
Major.
And I have major problems
And
just being honest.
I get you.
Yeah.
Now, and it's interesting, like if you think about millennials, this is where they're actually kind of similar to the boomers in this, right? Because that anti-authority mentality was pretty boomer friendly. And what you had for the boomers, you had the silent generation who were very pro-authority. Like, there was nothing that you could do. If your boss was your boss, you would jump off a bridge for your boss, right? Whether you respected the person, you at least respected the office, and that dictated how you behaved. So we're kind of swinging back to the pendulum a little bit on this, where boomers did some similar things, but there was still that influence from the silent generation enough to say, yeah, but it's still your job. You still got to do your job. Right? Yeah, that's good. What else? Any others?
I think for us in the city, we emphasize that entitlement mentality, that they feel entitled to things, and especially in academia. Stuff don't just happen right away. There are processes, there are boards that have to approve things, and I appreciate your creativity and your grand idea, but some things are going to have to go through an approval process, and so they just don't seem to get that.
Yeah. If you want shared governance, there's a model.
Let me give you an example. So I have a faculty member who should earn tenure this year and applied before she applied for tenure. She applied for sabbatical next month. So that's kind of, now it was kind of in the culture place I'm at, but still for me it was kind of like, wait a minute, let's you just barely get tenure and now you're going on sabbatical.
We'll talk about that a little bit more. What else? Any others?
I had a question which I was sharing with my colleagues here, and that is, does the country of origin matter when it comes to humans? Given that in my department, I have three millennial colleagues, two of them from China and one from Wisconsin, which is a different republic. I tend to spend more time with this colleague from Wisconsin. Given a couple of things, the entitlement is just overwhelming. It's just expressive, and that borders into whining also, and all those things. So I tend to, rather than let it fester, I just, you know, address it really quickly. Whereas the two from China are very accepting of it.
Yeah.
And I have to say subconsciously that I use authority on them, which I shouldn't have,
right.
Knowing where they're coming from.
Right.
So there's that Machiavellian instinct, I guess.
For sure.
So I'm just curious.
No, I think that is a fantastic point. I think across the board, you're seeing differences with this particular age group. And I think that's part of it, I think, is technology and the platforms that have been created by new media. I think there are some differences across the board, no matter what your country of origin, compared to generations prior, right? Now, with that said, I think you bring up a great point. Like, I think a lot of these characteristics are primarily Western in terms of the extent to which we're seeing them play out. Right? But I think that's great.
So I think you're right that each generation now will be more, regardless of national origin.
Yeah. Well, and here's what's interesting to me. So look at what Pew did with the Generation Z gap. So they made it 15 years, similar to what they did with the millennials. I would not be shocked. I would be surprised if it's halved. But I would not be shocked if by the time that this generation truly comes to a place where you can understand a little bit more about them, that you're going to see a Generation Z gap from about 1997 to 2005. And I think you're going to continue to see that because things are changing so rapidly. Like, they were close to doing that with millennials, to where they said, you know what, somebody who was born in 1991 is actually drastically or different than somebody born in 1981. So I don't know. So it would not shock me if we're, you know, in 20 years we're having a different conversation about generational differences than we're looking at and saying every 5 years, everything's changing, right? And expectations are changing.
So Rusty's going to talk just a little bit just about the new professorate, because I think that this is important. And then Shanti and Kevin have some different vignettes and some stories to tell.
So we wanted to highlight an overview here of what we're thinking of, what we've conceptualized as the new professoriate. So, you know, the traditions of the academic institution, at least at my university, and I think this is true, or comparable at least to universities where all of the panelists work, is we prioritize certain things, and often they're kind of funneled into three pillars. So scholarship, teaching, and service. I'm working at a regional comprehensive of about 16,000 students. We have about 400 tenure-track faculty. My academic home is in the English department. I came through that traditional academic channel. Earned a PhD, graduated, walked across the stage in Florida, and moved to Kentucky. And this was like 3 days apart. It was a pretty linear path, but I felt like I had a pretty good idea of what I was expecting and what was expected at a regional comprehensive. You have to publish. They're looking for certain numbers, certain journals. There are statistics, there are measurements for this. Teaching needs to be at a certain level. We value teaching, so we look at student perception of instruction in a certain way. We look at the numbers, we look at the percentages. We have to do a teaching observation year, those expectations were pretty clear. I was a little bit unique in that I was also moving into a tandem administrative role. So I've never known a role as a tenure track faculty member that wasn't also tied to an administrative role. So I came in as an assistant professor and also a director at the same time, which is sort of a unique perspective as well, because not only do you have these sort of the traditional academic challenges, you also have some leadership tied to that as well. But moved right through, and when I was eligible for tenure and promotion, I recently went up for promotion, and then again, waited the timeline, went up for full, and, you know, kind of got in line, you know, respected the process and all that. I don't know how typical it is. I think Strauss's experience here is potentially a little bit different. In some of the generational research, I could be classified as a millennial, but I think that we, you know, how we're coming into the system is really kind of how we're oriented to it. So I went through, had a very good experience at new faculty orientation, and I said, okay, here's a pathway. But we have those streams, and those streams are pretty traditional, and they've been around for a long time. Those pillars. Use of technology, though. Millennial faculty, I mean, we're used to, we're sort of conditioned to work online, use social media, right? We're sort of inclined. In terms of community engagement and institutional service, those metrics can be a little bit of a gray area. So most of you probably have service responsibilities for your tenure stream faculty. It may or may not involve like true community service, but committee service, et cetera, maybe a bit of a gray area, but the expectations are there. There is some sort of service expectation. Again, it can be very complicated when we talk about millennial faculty and the expectations there. Many of you, especially at teaching intensive universities, will have faculty with some advising responsibility or responsibilities elsewhere on campus. More and more, that work, at least at a regional comprehensive, is being asked of the faculty. So some involvement as we have conversations about enrollment and as students are moving through classes, faculty expectation is often aligned with advising. And so communication to various audiences. This is also another area that is rapidly changing. For those of you on social media, you might have seen kind of the evolution about how we talk about research, when an article is published, et cetera. A lot of information is getting pushed through different channels that are traditional in the academic sense and that we value, kind of a single author or maybe a multi-author article in a national journal that has those metrics. But I think we're talking about those in a different way, and we're seeing that conversation emerge as millennials are coming to campus and also taking on leadership roles. So we'll talk about some specific examples from Kevin and Shanti's areas here related to some of these bullet points.
Sure. All right, thank you. So I'm just going to share a couple of my experiences with millennial faculty and kind of seeing the differences that kind of match up with what we've heard and differences with the other faculty that I'm dealing with. So one that struck me that was kind of talked about was the loyalty to career, right? The longevity of staying in one career. And I've really seen a difference. I've got a great example for you. One of my nice new millennial faculty, she came to me having been the PR person for the Miami International Airport. She was their public relations person. She did a year there. Then she did a year at the Seminole Harbor Hotel and Casino, where she was the social media manager, the PR manager, all of that. She went and got a PhD from the University of Miami, which is a fantastic degree, great communication. Now she is working for me as full-time faculty. And she's fantastic in what she does, and she was very energized and for a couple of years, very active, doing lots of different kinds of service projects for us. And then she came to me and she said, okay, I don't want to do that anymore. And I said, okay, because we were very dependent on her for some of these amazing things she was doing. She said, but it's okay, I understand. Maybe if I can't do that here, maybe this isn't the right place for me, maybe I'll go somewhere. I said, no, you can stay. You don't have to do that extended service kind of thing that you were doing. You can go back to the more traditional. She was just interested in something else. But that was, for me, I got really used to faculty who come in, they have an area, they're doing what they do, and they kind of continue on that path. And here's someone who's had kind of just these multiple career paths, and then when she first came to me doing this one, really, had this one trajectory, and then just wanted to do something else, and I didn't want to lose her because she's fantastic, so we're doing something else, but I definitely see that. I also see the constant communication, constant feedback with her and with some other of the newer faculty. They send me, I've never seen anything like this before, but I get these emails with for approval in the subject line. And so there, I have faculty who I never hear from. I have to make appointments just so I can know they still exist. Hi, how are you? What's going on? Can you talk to me? We get a little get together at the beginning of the semester. What's your plan? And then hopefully I see them again, at some point at the department meeting. But for lots of texting, right? Which faculty do you not even have their cell phone numbers compared to the ones that are texting me at all hours? And so I definitely see a difference there. And then just one little story to share with you, something that really stood out to me, a marked difference between how faculty deal with critical feedback. So course evaluations, student evaluations. I have a faculty member who's older, right? Not in that millennial category. He received some critical feedback from a student evaluation, course evaluation. And just based on that critical comment, he actually decided to forego going up for a merit increase, even though he'd done a lot of other great work, because he would have had to put a portfolio together, would have gone through a committee, people would have seen that comment, and he just was like, I'd rather people didn't even know it existed. Fast forward to the new faculty, two of them got, first time they got their student evaluations, one of them, actually two, got focused on one, got some critical feedback. She contacted me immediately. She sent it to me. She brought it to my attention. She wanted me to know about it. She wanted to set up a meeting. We need to talk about it. The nurturing, we were talking about nurturing. She was really flustered. She brought it to my attention as her supervisor, right? Whereas the other woman, the other person would have really been happy if I had never found out. Like, let's just move on. With her, it was, I just got this. Did you see this? You know, and like, let's talk about it, and really brought it to my attention. And then when I was really worried, once I finally looked at it, it wasn't that bad. It was really, I didn't think it was such a big deal. But I just saw such a difference between the kind of communication that they want to have with me, what they want to talk with me about, let's resolve this, let's, right? So I just wanted to share some of those things that I've noticed.
And thank you, everybody. I'm going to reintroduce myself as our representative from Generation X, as your angry latchkey kid. Thank you for that language, I appreciate it. And I'm going to talk for a moment about my contribution to their collection. And it's not so much a recommendation, but more questioning of what we're doing in regards to collaboration. As you heard from Michael, if just about everything he's doing is a collaborative effort, then how do we ensure that our new faculty have these opportunities, we respect these opportunities, we give them a space and place for them? So thinking along those lines of collaboration, I think in terms of space and place. I think in terms of third space theory, which in short for this particular purpose would be a blend of social and work, and how do we get those two together, a la coffee shop environment, and then thinking about co-working spaces, which are becoming more and more popular. WeWork no longer includes beer, so I'm not suggesting that we have alcohol on premises, but thinking about how these two different types of environments can be brought into our departments. Luckily for me, I run a writing and communication center. We've got about 3,000, 3,500 square feet of brand new space, only 2 years old, modern design, everything is on wheels, everything is mobile. We can redesign the space in place to meet any need of any given hour. We have large glass windows in between rooms, so there's always a sight line to what everybody else is doing. And so in this space, I have three faculty coordinators, one of whom is 34, I believe, and another colleague who's not a coordinator, but I work closely with, who's also 34. And I think about the opportunities they've been having to collaborate in this space, and how the coordinator has created what she calls a series of write-ins. And write-ins are basically that co-working space theory of, all right, we're going to change this large room into a co-work space where we are going to write for the next 3 hours. Everybody's invited. If you're working on a dissertation, if you're working on a thesis, if you're a faculty member working on any kind of academic or personal project, come on in. We're going to write together. We're going to work together. This is not a moment we're going to necessarily talk and give feedback. It's just we're going to show up for work and we're going to write. And if you're not familiar with the co-working space, it's a place where you can basically rent out a room or a little desk or a little spot daily, monthly, yearly, and you go and you work in that environment. And one of the bigger things about the co-working space is that it brings people from a variety of companies, organizations together, differences together, and people work independently, or you might get to know a colleague who's been there 3 days in a row. Who's that guy over there? You know what? Maybe I'll see him and we'll start talking, we'll figure out a networking plan that my work for my company can meet the needs of his work for his company. And this is fascinating, fascinating difference in the way we used to work. Boomers showed up at an office for maybe 30, 40 years. I can think of elders in my family who worked for an organization in the same building in Manhattan 30 years in a row. And so this is a drastic, drastic change from that. So I think in terms of if we have this new group coming in, this is a bit of an expectation. How might we use writing centers, writing and communication centers, as that focal point, as a meeting space, or how might we even create spaces in our departments or somewhere on campus where faculty can come in and work independently, and your faculty from a bio department might be with faculty from communication, might be with faculty from psychology. Because think about the way our departments are likely structured right now. You only work with your colleagues in your area. You don't often get to work in a same physical space as colleagues from other areas. And thinking about some of the wonderful work Shanti has done with her space right now, formerly Department of Writing Communication, there was a simple, there were two hallways, one longer than the other, and a simple pass-through that connected them. So that pass-through had, you know, a fairly standard door size, just of this, and was not, it is not bigger than this little space that I exist in right now. And looking at it originally, it's a simple pass-through. What do you do with it? Nothing, you walk through it, you connect hallways. No. How about putting a large 60-inch monitor on one wall, two large glass whiteboards on catty corner walls, two cork boards, and put four small tables in, rolling wheels, chairs, everything. And that's the space where the communication interns work on social media projects with one of those faculty she was referring to before, because her office is right over there. So these students are now in the department working all the time. So they get to work and network with faculty from communication or from writing. So you get to meet these students throughout the course of the semester. They get to know who they are. She also redid the conference room that was connected to the department. Similar technology, similar furniture, as a place and space where faculty in the department could meet more easily than meeting in a little tiny office with each other. So again, if this is a really strong value, the collaboration, how do we foster it more on campus?
So look at this. We actually had planned group discussion, and we drastically underestimated our time. So I'm going to have Rusty go to our last slide, because we did want to give you some kind of tangible takeaways, right? While these are up and while Rusty's kind of going through all of these, I'm going to call an audible for us, and I'm going to empower you, okay? So if you have specific questions about millennial faculty or about kind of engaging millennial faculty, then I'm inviting you to email me and ask me your specific question. What we'll do is we'll write up kind of a collaborative response to that and include it as part of our conference proceedings. So if there are specific examples or specific things you go, man, I would love some just direct thoughts on this, then that I think will be, we'll at least try to answer that, and we'll submit that as part of the conference proceedings. But we at least wanted to give you something tangible, so I think Rusty can go over these quick, and then you can get to the next session.
Sure. I'll highlight these very quickly. So based on some of the generational research that we discussed, some of your perspectives here, we'll offer a few recommendations. Millennials are often very values-driven and often want to work in departments where they align with the mission and the vision that department department promotes. So there's this cultural acclimation that is very critical for millennials. Systems, think about the systems in your departments or in your areas. At what point are you acknowledging faculty? You have internal or external awards? How are you giving feedback? How quickly are you delivering feedback? Where does that rank on the many things that you're expected to do on a daily basis? Millennials are often expecting that feedback on their work. So many of us, you know, some of us grew up with technology. Think about the ways that technology is integrated into department workflows. My dean is not a millennial. However, I have trained her to use Google Docs, and we are constantly in Google Docs working on various aspects of faculty development, and now have this entire network. So that was more efficient. And once you know we were able to kind of establish that as a virtual kind of co-working space, even though previously you know the communications were driven by emails and attachments, we're now sort of in this whole world, and I know that much of the college level, you know, administrative work is being shared among the department chairs via these very kind of efficient networks, just as an example there. Structures that acknowledge and value collaboration. Depending on your type of university, the single authored manuscript could be kind of the tier one. That could be problematic for millennials coming into departments or various university systems. Like Michael, a number of my papers are collaborative, and I value that work. I value multiple perspectives. It allows for an efficiency, a depth of knowledge in the work that we're doing. So if you are at a college or institution that values and sort of preferences the single author or the lead author, I think we can get out in front of that a little bit and prep for the next group. So multiple pathways there for developing faculty who are coming in with that expectation and potentially to look at other disciplines, medicine, sciences, where research is moving very quickly. There's a value in the efficiency there and a multitude of perspectives that we can have. Millennials, a lot of the research suggests that there's a good deal of value placed on family and friends and life outside of the traditional office. Kevin mentioned this, co-working spaces. So he gave us some really practical examples of ways that Nova Southeastern has adjusted those sort of workspaces. However, I think we run into questions, we run into concerns when millennials are called to sort of these traditional looking meetings that don't have a specific outcome, don't have a specific purpose, right? If you use Outlook, your calendars fill up, you're back to back. You know, often, think about the times of day when this work is being scheduled. We want to get the most out of our faculty. We want them to be successful. And positioning of meetings, when those are happening, the format for those, at what point do we really need to meet in person? What does the structure of that conversation look like? And at what point might we be more productive in, say, moving to online spaces or moving to a different format for a meeting? Maybe we're moving into a neutral or a co-working space. So the pages of our book really come into a few of these recommendations, and we offer those to you as a practical way of moving forward. This isn't all the answers, but I know for me, in organizing sessions like new faculty orientation, seeing new faculty coming through, the opportunity to revisit and reflect on some intentional ways here has been really productive in how we do the best work possible for moving faculty into our campuses. I think with that, I know we have other sessions to get to, but the four of us would be happy to stick around, answer questions, or have some additional conversation with you. So thanks for joining us. We know that there are many other ways in Savannah that you could spend your time if you chose it to talk about millennial faculty. So enjoy the rest of the conference.
So am I doing it right if I'm taking pictures and texting my millennial?
faculty.
Yes.
Yeah, that's perfect.
You could also just tweet them.
I have a Twitter. So I've seen a number.
The next slide had your.
I'm bored the first time I got my business. Oh, wait, that's smart.
I'm going to post it in the conference proceedings too, but I'll email it.
Thank you, for sure. He's teaching in ventilation. He's in the health science, and he's, you know, students are.
Wasn't that the final slide?
Yeah, but he went back, I think. I don't know why.
I know he needed those two, but I just thought maybe those you want.
It's just not cloud. That saves like 3 minutes. It's so much more efficient.
It's the first time I saw that.
Might be the shortest session.
Hi, hello.
Man, to expect.